people don't seem to get upset by the Stars and Bars, the first national flag. As a matter of fact, the Stars and Bars flies over Confederate graves at Shiloh National Battlefield. What is it about the Confederate battle flag that tends to get some people up in arms?
It is interesting that the Stars and Bars, and I'm so pleased that you're using Stars and Bars correctly for the first national flag rather than, as so many people do, as a name for the battle flag, the blue cross on the red field, of course, the battle flag that we're talking about. And as someone observed when I first started working on this subject 20 years ago, if there's one flag that people today ought to object to of Confederate flags, it should be the Stars and Bars, because that was the first flag of the nation of the Confederacy, of the seven original Deep South Confederate states, whose secession was pretty clearly based on defense of slavery from perceived attack from the North. So that if any flag should symbolize slavery and therefore be objectionable today, it should be the first national. But as you said, that's one that, for whatever reason, doesn't have that kind of association. So the answer is, in short, the baggage that the battle flag has acquired in the 150 years since its introduction. It has more to do with its use since the war than it does with its wartime use. And it is sort of counterintuitive, but there you have it, there it is.
Hmm. Why do you think the battle flag is such a powerful symbol? I mean, is it the shape, the color, the simplicity of it? Is it this symbol that draws you into the center of the flag?
You're certainly correct. The visual, the colors and the shape and simplicity, artist friends of mine have said the same thing, that it's a perfect logo. It's just a logo to die for, because it is so good as a symbol, so effective in drawing attention. So in many ways, it is a victim of its own success as a graphic element. You have to consider that artistic part, artistic dimension to it, that is, in evaluating why it has become the symbol of the Confederacy. One of the points I try to make in my book is that the effort to completely separate the battle flag, which of course began life as a battle flag of what became Lee's Army of Northern Virginia, and it was associated primarily with the soldiers who fought the war, and especially the soldiers in the Eastern Army on whose efforts and successes the Confederacy depended so much. And it should, in other words, be a soldier's flag. And a lot of people today make the very common sense and apparently sound argument that that flag should be the soldier's flag and should just be exempt from any of the discussions and the debates, whatever you think about those debates, about the cause of the war or about the nature of the Confederacy and whether or not it was associated with slavery. All that, we can leave those arguments aside. This is a soldier's flag, pure and simple. Well, it's the sort of argument that would solve things if it were true. But the fact is, it isn't true, because if you look at the flags that succeeded the first national flag of the Confederacy, and beginning in May of 1863, it was nothing but a white flag with the battle flag in the upper left-hand corner in the canton. And then the third national flag of the Confederacy that flew during the last months of the war, basically the same flag with a vertical red bar on the fly end, as it's called, of the flag. So in other words, the last 2 years of the war, the Confederacy's national flag, symbolizing the nation, not simply the soldiers anymore, highlighted that blue cross on the red field flag. And the reason they adopted it is because that flag had been consecrated by the victories of the armies, and also that it was the more appropriate flag for a truly independent nation, not a flag that was, as the first national was, a deliberate mimicking of the Stars and Stripes. So the first national was the right flag during the weaning period, if you would, of Confederate nationalism. But when the Confederate nationalism matured, it needed a mature flag. And the symbol that stood for the Confederate nation at that point was the old blue cross on the red field. So it's not possible to make this clean separation between the national symbol and the soldier symbol.
It's interesting that you point out the differentiation between the battle flag and a national flag. Although that portion of the second and third Confederate national flags had its origins really in a more practical way differentiating it between the stars and bars, which could be confused for the stars and stripes in the smoke of a battle.
Right, exactly. Yeah, there was the practical, it's the first National failed on two levels. It failed as a battle flag when it was used as a battle flag at Manassas, First Bull Run, and other places because, as you say, it was too easily confused. It didn't have that necessary element that a battle flag should have, which is distinctiveness. And then it failed on a symbolic level, the idea that it was an imitation or a servile imitation, the critics said, of the Stars and Stripes was all right when people were still reluctant, still sort of longing for the old Union. They wished it hadn't been necessary to leave the old Union. But 2 years later, after tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of deaths and Union invasions of Southern soil and Southerners wondering how they ever shared a Union with those people up in the North. They're so different and they don't like us and they're invading our territory. And all the things that had happened in those 2 years that made Southerners want to have a distinctive symbol. But of course, ultimately, as you said, the battle flag was a functional symbol to begin with. It was a distinctive symbol on the battlefield to help generals guide their troops and troops to recognize each other from the enemy.
In your book, The Confederate Battle Flag, I got the sense that there was this very relatively clear separation of the perception of the flag before the Civil Rights Movement and then after the Civil Rights Movement. What were the attitudes of African Americans toward the battle flag before that Civil Rights Movement and its proliferation among racist groups?
That's a great question, and that clearly is what plays into the debates today. It certainly has a lot to do with the Civil War and the Confederacy and the Confederacy's association with slavery. And that alone would provoke what would make the battle flag, which has become the primary symbol of the Confederacy, it would make that symbol controversial to some degree. But the main reason for the controversy surrounding the battle flag has to deal with what's happened in our own time. But long story short, before about late 1940s or so, the battle flag was relatively constricted in its uses. It was basically the property and used almost exclusively by organizations that revered it and almost exclusively in ways that made sense. There were memorial uses at veterans' parades and reunions and meetings of organizations of descendants of Confederates, at Memorial Day parades and observations of solemn occasions, particularly Memorial Day and Confederate holidays. What happened in the late 1940s was its entry into popular culture, and this is all sort of an indirect way of answering the civil rights question, because it became a symbol of Southern schools playing Northern schools in football. It became a symbol of Southern servicemen serving among servicemen from all over the country in World War II in Korea. It became not just a Confederate symbol, but a Southern symbol. It was a totem of people who wanted to identify themselves as Southerners, and in their hands, it also became a symbol of rebellion, of the personal quality of being a rebel. So it took on more generic meanings, and this apparently happened through Confederate heritage movements, heritage organizations, particularly Kappa Alpha fraternity, at colleges and universities. So it went from being a symbol of heritage to a symbol of hijinks, if you will, of youthful hijinks. All the while, the Confederate heritage organizations were trying to keep a lid on that kind of thing because they recognized a fundamental truth that the more widely it is used, the more carelessly it is used, the more likely these groups are to lose control of it and its meaning, that they would no longer have ownership over it and be able to determine what it means more generally. And that, of course, is exactly what has happened. Enter now the Civil Rights Movement, the Brown decision occurred just a couple of years after the national media gave wide coverage to something they called the flag fad. That was a nationwide flag fad of people. It was akin to hula hoops and coonskin caps, youthful fads of the late 1940s and 50s. So that symbol was sort of in the air in the late 40s and 50s and was adopted first by the Dixiecrat Party, by youthful supporters anyway, mostly college kids, who were already accustomed to having it on campus, and they took it to the convention of the States' Rights Party in Birmingham, Alabama in 1948, and they were captured by the cameras, by the world media. Here's a secessionist movement in the Democratic Party, a states' rights party based very clearly on resistance to civil rights, and there's this battle flag. Well, what happened the last time the South seceded? What was their symbol? This battle flag. And now the South is seceding again from the Democratic Party, and once again they turn to this symbol. So it immediately, in 1948, launched that symbol into the national consciousness as a symbol of Southern rebellion and defense of segregation, and thus resistance to integration and civil rights. And it became worse with the when the Klan began using it more generally in the 1950s after the Brown decision. That was a game changer. One of the effects of it that's been kind of subtle, but I think very important, is that the groups that first reacted against the youthful adoption of the flag by saying, kids, put that flag away, that's not a good use of that flag, this is a sacred symbol, it should only be used on sacred occasions. Those groups, some of them anyway, compromised that sort of very strict definition of what proper use of the flag was, and they started defending the use of the flag and, in fact, promoting it in direct proportion to how African Americans were saying, put it away. In other words, they sort of changed their terms in reaction to African Americans' objections to the flag.
I have to admit, when I came to that section in your book about the flag fad, what popped into my head, of all things, was a scene in Animal House where they're in one of the guys' rooms and hanging on the wall is a battle flag.
In popular culture, like even in the movie Pulp Fiction, it's on the wall of a gun shop where a couple of notable things happen in that movie. And it connotes something sort of evil and intimidating. And sure enough, that's what happened in the film. It took an odd direction, and there was a Confederate flag on the wall. And the automatic association when you saw that flag on the, in the film was, uh-oh, something's going to happen. And indeed it did. And that's how the symbol has been transformed in our lifetimes.
Well, I do want to get back to that, but let me ask, as you researched your book and addressed the various controversies that have occurred around the Southeast over the last 50, 60 years, have you noticed any kind of pattern to these situations? Is there a certain way that they tend to play out?
There is. They occur mostly on the local level at schools and the like. There are First Amendment cases where kids wear T-shirts to schools and they get maybe suspended, and then the ACLU and other organizations intervene to help to defend their First Amendment rights to display their symbols on their clothing or on their notebooks or whatever else. And schools are kind of different from other places. But those are the run-of-the-mill, the so-called T-shirt cases. The ones you're referring to are the big ones on the state-level cases, the flags over the domes of Alabama and South Carolina, and on the state flags of Georgia formerly, and still Mississippi. They tend to be polarizing and polarized, but yet most people in those states and involved in these issues are somewhere in the middle, but yet there's a kind of dynamic that tends to polarize it and make it seem that everyone is at each other's throats and they're completely incompatible viewpoints. But most people tend to have a kind of common sense attitude toward flags. They can make the distinction between the right to fly it on one's own property and the flying on the state house, for example. Or you can put it on your car, but it shouldn't be on the state flag, that kind of thing. So there's a dynamic, and as we were talking about earlier, the first national flag, the Stars and Bars, is often suggested as an alternative, a kind of how to have a Confederate flag without having a Confederate flag that offends people because it doesn't have the baggage of the battle flag. That usually enters into the to the course of the debate as well.
Well, getting back to the I guess a culturalization of the Confederate battle flag, are we ever going to get to a point where it largely, I don't know that it ever will completely, but it largely sheds that baggage?
Darn good question. I would have thought, my book appeared 7 years ago now, and I thought that after the Georgia state flag was finally sort of settled, although some people would say it's not settled yet, that things would settle down for a while. And I think they kind of have, but they seem to go in cycles. I mean, they're in the immediate aftermath of the Civil Rights Movement, and as African Americans were getting a voice in local politics, and they were in a position to have a voice about with those flags. Those flags that had been put up around the southern landscape on stores and on courthouses and on official and unofficial places, street names and the like, they really hadn't had a significant role in determining whether or not that was proper. And once they got their voice, they protested against it in the late 1960s and into the 1970s. And then the issue died out again until the NAACP raised the issue again on a regional level in the Southeast in late 1987, 88. And that set off another wave that really extended until the resolution of the Georgia flag issue in 2004, I guess it was. And then it sort of died back again. But what's happening in Paducah is part of a, I won't say a new pattern, but a continued pattern that has played out around the nation. There have been flags put on private property on in prominent locations over interstates in Georgia and in Florida along I-95, and on private property and in a similar memorial park in Point Lookout, Maryland, after a court decision forbade the use of the flying of the flag around the clock at Point Lookout proper. So that seems to be part of a pattern, a kind of pushback, if you will, to display the flag prominently. And then that pushback, in turn, has evokes a predictable response, and there we go. Here we go again, round in circles.
Well, I think it probably goes without saying that the battle flag is always going to be a part of local and certainly regional culture. My last question is, do you think that there's a place for the Confederate battle flag among our national symbols?
What I've written, and I guess I would still think this is a rational answer 7 years later, is that, well, I mean, I think I agree with you on the inevitability of it. It is, as I refer to it in the book, the second American flag that goes back to or speaks to the simple, undeniable fact that, and it's subtle, and yet we don't look at it very often, that the people who fought against the national authority in 1861-65 were allowed back into the nation. They weren't executed. They weren't forced into re-education camps. Reconstruction did not involve requiring people to forsake their culture, their dead, their heroes. In fact, quite the opposite. They've been allowed over the century to erect statues to the dead and to have the symbols that meant something to them when they were in defiance of the federal government, which is pretty darn unique. But that century of allowance, of toleration of the symbols of a defeated rebel nation has laid the groundwork for that flag being part of our popular culture, and to purge it from the culture is almost impossible, and it's asking a lot of the people who for whom it means a lot. The question is whether the flag can take a place that what I write in the book is as an unambiguous historical or memorial symbol. In trying to apply common sense as well as civility, really, to questions like this, to try to find a place that doesn't make it speak for people who don't want it to speak for them, thus not on places, on public property, on courthouses, on state symbols that that symbolize people who don't revere it, but finding a sort of a safe haven as a historical symbol that simply means as objectively as you can make it that the Confederacy was here too, that the Confederacy was its simple recognition of the fact of the Confederacy as an important part of American history. Or here lie the graves of those men who fought and died under this flag. And whatever you might think of the cause for which they fought, this was their symbol, and here they are. It seems to me that's the proper place, is as an historical symbol, a memorial symbol that doesn't try to represent or speak for all the people in a given entity, and one that doesn't confuse the past and the present. Anytime that flag seems to symbolize the South will rise again, or should rise again, or that the Confederacy never died, there's simply an armistice and the war goes on. If it is ever displayed in that kind of context, there's obviously going to be a problem. I mean, common sense tells you that.
You talk about changing the message that it communicates. How can we do that? I mean, is it someone starting another Descendants of Confederate Veterans organization and promoting that message? Because it seems as though the SCV has really, in a lot of ways, repoliticized it, I suppose. I don't know if that's the appropriate term, but it certainly seems that way to me.
It seems to me a couple of things have to happen for it to disappear from the controversial landscape or to become more, more benign. One thing is the passage of the Civil Rights Generations. Even if a person who flies that flag doesn't mean it as a racist symbol, there are people who have encountered it as a racist symbol. They know from firsthand experience or good oral history people whom they revere that this flag was once used by people who wanted to deny us fundamental rights or people who meant me harm. And that is a fact. So there is not an irrational reaction to a symbol that they inherently detest or they're not being brainwashed by anyone. They had experience with these symbols. There's a generation who did experience that symbol as a symbol of hostility and even as a threatening symbol, passes, perhaps in the current generation lost in their iPods, it means nothing to them. They don't have the same visceral reaction to that symbol on the receiving end. That may help to make it more benign. But at the same time, it's up to the people who fly it and display it to start doing so in a more benign way. It's up to them to display it in a way that is more unambiguously historical. Anytime it's displayed in a way that seems to be literally waving the red flag in people's faces, yes, what else is it going to do but annoy people? What else is it going to do but inflame reactions if it's flown in a way that is meant to inflame? It's meant to get attention. It's meant to make a point. It's a gesture. For all intents and purposes, it's a gesture. And whenever you use a symbol to make a gesture, naturally people are going to react in lots of different ways. Some will react in the way you want them to. They'll appreciate the gesture. But we're a diverse country. We see that all the time in our blue state, red state arguments. So a symbol that's out there, in this case flying from off the side of the highway, you put the symbol out there in the marketplace of ideas, and you have your perfect freedom to do so. But don't be surprised when people react in ways other than the ways you want them to act, and they in turn push back at you because they see that symbol to mean something different than what you do. And it becomes an object of controversy, and does that really serve your purpose, or does that in fact simply perpetuate negative perceptions of the flag rather than perpetuating or creating a positive association.